Hi guys, welcome back to another episode at the MHP podcast. Today we'll be talking about regressions, why it's necessary to train other limbs when an individual is injured, as well as the importance of training calves. All right, so to start it off, I know that in previous episodes we've talked about how progressions are important to kind of keep challenging the system and overloading it. But relating this more to regressions, so quite the opposite. Can they lead to muscular hypertrophy, especially when talking about chin-ups and pull-ups? Or do they always lead to a detraining state since they're the opposite to progressions?
It depends on what kind of fills the space of what you're taking away. Because usually a regression is, a simpler form of the exercise or lower weight or some sort of assistance. And oftentimes, if done with the right intent, you get to fill that space with something else that makes up for it. So if you just took a regular, we'll get to push-ups and chin-ups, but if you take just a regular exercise that uses some sort of load added to it, and you decrease that load, that creates the space for bigger range of motion, slower tempos, and even in the case of if you're trying to target a very specific muscle, being a little more honed in on the technique and the isolation of potentially that tissue or that muscle. So to decrease the load allows these things to come into play. Now, if you don't put your intention into any of those categories, then the decrease in load is just a lighter stimulus and probably just gets you less than you would have otherwise. But being intentional in those areas can fill that space. When it comes to body weight exercises like pull-ups, push-ups, things like that, the reduction of load is basically just associated with body weight. So adding some assistance like a band on the pull-ups or going on an incline for the push-ups can allow the same thing to increase the range of motion, decrease the tempo, and decrease as in make it longer, and then certain technical aspects. This has more implications when it comes to hypertrophy or, working around an injury. Because if you're really trying to target a specific muscle, that because maybe it's weak or is having a problem, then that's where these things could come into play. But when it comes to, a max strength output, could be a little different.
And kind of relating this to an athlete who's actually trying to achieve a chin-up or a pull-up, at what point should an athlete actually add the resistance band when trying to increase their pull-ups from, say, 2 to 5? What would you really follow?
For sure. So if obviously if you can't do any at say current day, then adding assistance is just where you're going to start. That would be, although doing some general strengthening, say in the case of a pull-up, doing things like a lat pull-down can help transfer. The most specific way you're going to develop that quality is doing an assisted version of the exercise because the core muscles are involved, and just the way that you have to maneuver your body around a pull-up is a lot different from a lat pull-down where you're anchored into a
That's very
seat.
true.
So that would be the very simple recommendation. On the flip side, if you're in a position where, say, your max chin-ups or pull-ups are under 5, and you're trying to either increase that number or work up to even doing loaded pull-ups,
Under the
then
training belt.
yeah. So in that instance, it's valuable to not only do like a max set of 4 or 5 chin-ups. It's valuable to add some assistance, do sets in the 8 to 12 or more range to build up the muscle tissue that's involved. And then because you're looking for a specific strength stimulus, it's important that you're not only training at those higher rep ranges, you would also sprinkle in your normal unassisted pull-ups so that you're getting that higher strain kind of stimulus.
And this is kind of out of curiosity, but aside from resistant bands, why do eccentric like pull-ups work? Because I know a lot of people sometimes they say that like a really good way to build it aside from the resistance band is also just like pulling yourself up and then slowly going down. So going through that like eccentric phase, why is that beneficial and why is that focused more than just the concentric, which is actually pulling yourself up?
So that gets into a very fascinating topic, which is when maybe it seems like common sense, but I feel like when you look at a gym environment, it's maybe not utilized as if it's common sense.
Right.
But I think we all know you could pick up a weight and lower it, that's so heavy that there's no way you could lift it. You could take a weight that you can't lift and you could lower it. That's kind of the essence of it. So if you can currently do zero pull-ups, you could probably use, say, a step or a box to get up to the top of the pull-up, and then you could probably do a decent controlled eccentric lowering of it, even though there's no way you're getting back up. And what that's doing is it's overloading those muscles, and you're strengthening the exact movement, the exact exercise that you're trying to enhance, without having to worry about that ability to lift yourself up. In different contexts, this doesn't just have to be applied to things like pull-ups. I've used things like an overloaded split squat, where you're basically unracking a bar with a weight that you have zero chance of putting back up. And you basically just for 5 seconds or as slow as you can, you're trying to lower it in as controlled a fashion as possible. And then when it's at the bottom, the rep is done. It's a
Like you
pain
drop the
because,
weight, you're done.
yeah, it's a pain because then you gotta get out and reset the bar back at the top. And it's not the most efficient training style, although to be fair, there are simpler ways to do it. Like you could do a split squat with two heavy dumbbells.
Exactly. So you don't have to like take it off your shoulders and then be able to back up. Yeah, of
With
course.
the dumbbells, you would just lower yourself as slow as possible and then put them on the floor at the bottom and then just come up without the added load. So that's a tool that can be very very valuable, and oftentimes there's some very reputable experienced coaches that use a really heavy eccentric phase as almost like a phase one, where you spend a long, long period either doing overloaded eccentrics, meaning loads you wouldn't be able to lift, or just exaggerated eccentrics, where you're doing the full up and down, but the lowering part is like 3 to 5 seconds. And that builds a really good strength foundation. And it also forces you to slow things down and really own these positions that you'll then go and train in other ways later. So, a very good tool.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the second topic that we're talking about today, I feel like it's a very, very common misconception. Mainly talking about when athletes are injured. Sometimes people think that if you're injured, you're just supposed to not do any gym related movements. Especially if a medical professional tells you, you gotta rest. But why is that wrong?
Yeah, that's a big problem, because and I it's hard to place blame on anyone, because if you go
Totally.
and you've say you've separated your shoulder, something nasty's happened up here, and whoever the medical professional in question is looking at it and is thinking, if this guy goes into the gym, he's gonna mess something up, something's gonna break, something like
Or even something's gonna fall on him, and it's just, yeah, there's so many risks.
there's that too. There's the accidents are a real thing to account for. But I think it's just the lack of nuance of like, exercise is going to make this worse. So then the prescription is no exercise, stay out of the gym, just rest, stay at home. And if you have either someone experienced working with you, or you have some enough like experience in the gym to be able to navigate things yourself without, risking things, you can very easily navigate this and not put the injury at any risk and still continue to train and develop and keep yourself fit. So the first factor here is the cross training effect. If you have a left arm that is completely immobilized, whether that means it's in a cast or a sling or whatever the case is, if you've basically been told not to move it, the problem you're facing is that the muscles in that arm are going to atrophy, and that's pretty well an unavoidable aspect, but there's a lot of interesting research around the cross-training effect, where if you take an arm that's completely immobilized and you train hard on the other arm, which means you're never even moving the injured side, the injured arm comes out of the immobilization on the other side with more muscle than if you did it. So that's one very important aspect, because if you have a very serious injury, one of the biggest things you battle when you come out of it is building up that atrophied muscle tissue, because you have a limb that is trying to recover from an injury. Nice. Is trying to recover from an injury.
Agree.
It's you're trying to recover from an injury and you're in a weaker state than you ever have been. And it's not a good combo. So that is the one thing you want to avoid. And then on the flip side, because you've been told not to do anything, cardiovascular fitness is going to go down. Even if you're talking about upper body, like the lower body is going to atrophy. Everything's just going to decline if you're not paying attention to it.
Yeah, and also what I learned in school is that an athlete actually declines, especially cardiovascular health, way faster than an average individual does because their maintenance rate is higher because they're
Like they're
continuously
starting
lifting
from a
weights.
higher point.
Exactly. So they're actually losing it faster, which is insane. Yeah. And so kind of relating this more, I guess, to physiology, more sciencey, what are the three physiological effects that occur from training other limbs that are non-impacted by the injury? So for example, if you injured exactly your shoulder, but you're training your lower body or vice versa.
So there's three different factors you want to focus on, or that you benefit from. First is the hormone factor. So if you go get, say again, you have the shoulder injury. If you go do a really heavy lower body workout, and again, be mindful of the shoulder, and I wouldn't be doing a bunch of jumps and things where that arm's gonna be swinging around. You want to be doing things in a controlled fashion. But say, even if you just had a really heavy session on like the leg extension machine and the hamstring curl machine, think things where you're seated, everything's controlled, but you really exerted yourself. What happens in that case, or with any heavy strength training stimulus, is you get increases in growth hormone and testosterone and all these beneficial hormones that don't just exist in the legs where you train them. That's flowing through your bloodstream and
Yeah,
is touching every part of the
definitely.
body. So that injured arm, which by the way, guess what happens to an injury when it gets exposed to more growth hormone and things like that? It heals faster, usually. That's kind of like, to me, that would be a common sense assumption to make. I haven't seen a research paper on that, but I'm gonna stick to that as gospel. So that would be factor number one, would be the hormones. Then you can look at the nervous system. So anytime you do something with a lot of intent, whether that's a really heavy strength exercise or a really fast plyometric, the amount that the nervous system kind of lights up is a really big factor in that. And that doesn't just influence the arm. It's actually starting from the brain, running down the spinal cord. And so most of what's happening from a nervous system perspective is not even associated, like it's not connected to the arm, or it's connected to the arm, but it's separate from the arm.
That's
So
awesome.
if you're doing, and again, this is where things get tricky, because you don't want to be doing jumps and sprints and things where you're probably going to compromise something like a shoulder. But if we use the example of like your ankles in a cast, and you can sit on a box, put the ankle up on something, and then you can take a medicine ball and launch it into a wall with
Yeah,
some
it's
intent.
perfect.
Something like that, where you're not introducing risk to the ankle, but you're expressing something with that has some real intent. By the way, lower body injuries are the best, because it's a little easier to do heavy strength, heavy plyometrics
Yeah, because you can
by
actually breathe
plyometric.
it.
Yeah, and you can just kind of like sit and get the leg out of the way. Whereas the inverse, it's hard to do sprints and jumps and things when the arm is the thing in question. But
Totally. Unless we're talking about any type of like ACL or ligament, knee ligament injury, I think that's also equally as bad.
It's true. Yeah, you have to take it case by case. And then
Exactly.
there's this principle which is almost always true, which is the closer to your center the injury is, the harder it's going to be to kind of work around it. So like
Interesting.
a wrist is going to be easier than a shoulder. A
100%.
shoulder is going to be a heck of a lot easier than a spinal issue.
Yeah.
So
Super
as
true.
things get kind of up the chain from the hand to your center, from the foot to the center, things get a little more serious and require more and more caution. But yeah, so that's the thing, is if it's an ankle or a wrist, there's so much you can do, and there's actually kind of quite little restraint required. So that's fun. But the last factor here of the three is heart rate. So if you can do something to get your heart rate up, you can keep your cardiovascular fitness up, which,
Stops the decline.
yep, which is something you, again, if you're coming back and you're trying to get the strength back in the injured site, you're trying to rehab it, you're trying to get your full body strength back, you don't also want to be trying to get your fitness up at the same time. And that's probably the easier one to do, because if it's an
Sure.
upper body injury, just get on a bike. You can
Yeah,
do just as
and
hard.
conditioning even.
Yeah, you can do all the same conditioning that you would do otherwise, as in like the long, slow aerobic stuff. You can do heavy intervals. All that stuff is possible. And then I have a decent roster of athletes that hate me for this one, but if you have a lower body exercise, hopefully, if you have access to an assault bike, what you do is you put your feet up on the pegs, so not on the pedals. Feet go up on the pegs that don't move, and then it's all upper body, pushing the handles back and forth. And
Yeah, and the same
again,
results.
you can get all the same. You can do that long and slow for the aerobic benefits. You can do heavy intervals. That is all possible. Some gyms even have like an actual upper body cycle. It's like a,
It's the wheel. Yes, it's
so
efficient.
you just play with that. And even if you don't have any, like, even you can do things like seated battle ropes, and like there's all these options to get the heart rate up if you have a leg that you can't really do much on. So the point I would hope everyone takes away from this is there's no excuses.
Yeah,
And
I think what people commonly forget is that, like, especially if you put in no work when you actually are injured, you're gonna have to do that work anyways right after.
yep.
Like, and it's gonna be just as worse. But if even if, for example, you're going through like, an ACL injury, I know that happens quite often, in field sports. I know sometimes people actually build up their strength right before surgery. So then right after surgery, if they're on crutches and they can't walk because they have maybe like a meniscus tear, then, it's in a different story. But then they start doing the rehab pretty quickly after, and they're not staying still, They're getting moving, they're starting slow, but I think people really forget that just because you're not doing something during rest, it doesn't mean that you skip it. You're gonna have to pay that right after anyways. So you might as well start earlier.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a great point too, where usually the stronger you are before the injury, or before especially something like a surgery,
Yeah.
the easier things are on the other side, because
Exactly.
if the muscle's going to atrophy anyways, the higher the starting point is, the higher you'll be on the other side of it. So that's a big factor. I have seen a curious case of a meniscus injury where it was attempted to be treated non-surgically, just through exercise,
Oh, wow.
which eventually it was determined wasn't really working. So the
Yeah.
surgery was done and recovery time was almost zero,
Oh my
because
gosh.
so much work had gone into the area around the knee leading up to that point,
Right.
that once the actual part of the meniscus that was causing the issue was gone, all the strength was there. There was no issues, and it was a recovery that was, faster than you would normally, way
Exactly.
faster than you would normally see, but very, like, almost instant. It was Very interesting.
Strength is your best friend. That's the biggest takeaway.
Yep.
All right. So the last topic we'll be talking about today is actually quite interesting. And I think personally, and I'm sure you'll agree, Jacob, is the one muscle group in the whole body that people tend to forget, ignore. Even I'm a little bit guilty of that. So we're talking about training calves. So I was just wondering, Jacob, like, what is the main importance of having strong calves? Strong, healthy calves that you're constantly training.
Yeah, I think the easiest selling point is that anything athletic that you do, whether it's a sprint trying to push you forward or a jump trying to push you up, it's all the transfer of force through your feet into the ground. So almost everything requires some degree of your foot and lower leg calf, of its ability to stay stiff and not to kind of fold under pressure. So I think we actually talked about this a couple of weeks ago about like sprint form and how one of the biggest issues is that when, especially in younger athletes, when the foot hits the ground, the heel just kind of falls. And there's that inability to keep the calf stiff, that keep the ankle in a rigid position. So I'm going to kind of cheat this answer a little bit and talk about not just the calf, but kind of the whole lower leg. Because there's a couple different things you can think about here. So the first is thinking about the ankle in all four dimensions. The easiest would be the calf, which is just the plantar flexion of the ankle. But even there's a little bit of nuance where you have different muscles in that area that will get trained differently, whether the knee is straight or bent. So your standing calf raise is going to be a little bit different than doing like a seated bent knee calf raise. And both are super valuable. Both should have a little bit of prioritization in a program. But even then, that's just the one angle, because then you also have your dorsiflexion, which is you're pulling your toes up towards the knee. That's another area that deserves a little bit of focus. And then you have the two areas that get even less focused than the first two, which are your inversion, eversion. So like the
Totally.
muscles on the inside and the outside of the ankle, which are different from the calf muscles and play a big role. So that would be, things like we talked a little bit about the ankle dome, but like a banded inversion eversion, or like the ankle dome
Exactly.
that allows you to really load those side to side positions. And then when it comes to the way that you train all those different tissues, you would think of strength first. So just your basic calf raises and traditional kind of strength exercises. Then you would think about the endurance of those muscles. So that's where like a light extensive plyometric comes into play. Something like a really high rep of a low pogo hop, which is a very light hopping up and down off the floor, emphasizing keeping that ankle stiff and in
For a long period of
position.
time.
Yes. And then thinking multi-directional again, doing like a single leg hop where you're hopping sideways can then start to introduce more of those lateral muscles, lateral medial muscles into the equation, because it's not enough as an athlete to just be strong. You need to have some stiffness and some elasticity in these areas as well. So then once the endurance is set and you've built some capacity there, then you're looking at like max effort pogo hops where you're really hitting the ground for max height, trying to be quick off the floor. And then the progressions on that is max effort sprinting, like jumps. You're just athletic expression built on top of that. So those are a lot of different things to think about for this little area that gets neglected a lot of the times. But training in all four dimensions, and then training across the strength, endurance, and the kind of intensity components as well.
Well, there you go, guys. That brings us today to the end of this podcast. Make sure to give a follow and tune in for the next episode coming next week. Thank you so much, guys, for listening. We'll see you next week.
Absolutely. Thanks
Bye.
so much. See ya.